the topic for this afternoon's lecture is Mises and Rothbard and the history of economic thought. First of all, let me just draw two parallels between these economists and contrasts. I do consider them the two greatest economists of the 20th century. Okay, and you can rank them in different order, but they are definitely head and shoulders above other economists. They were born two generations apart. Okay, Mises was in the third generation of the Austrian school, and Rothbard actually in the fifth generation. And worlds apart in terms of culture. One was born in fin de siècle or turn of the century Vienna, Mises, and Rothbard was born in pre-war New York City. Okay. You can't think of two more divergent places culturally. Both worked in virtual isolation outside of the mainstream. And during very, very productive periods of their career, they were working in isolation. Both had extraordinary mental abilities, intellectual abilities, as we know, but they were both extremely humble intellectually. I spoke to Roth. I knew Rothbard personally and met with him many times. And he was an extremely humble person. And he was always referring to Paul Samuelson and the others in economics as the big shots of economics, okay? But he never tooted his own horn and, you know, talked about how his contributions, I mean, they were just there for everyone to see. A very humble man, would speak to anybody. When I first met him, I was in graduate school. I was a vice president of the New Jersey Libertarian Party, which consisted of me and a few other people. less than are in this room right now, half. If that. And he came from New York to New Jersey. Not a long trip, but, you know, he gave up a whole afternoon. And he was going to be our first convention speaker. And, you know, I asked him how much he wanted. And he said, well, you know, I'll take $75. I mean, he did it almost for nothing. And then time came when we were about to eat dessert. And I asked him if he would rather speak first. And then we'd have dessert if he wanted to eat dessert first. He says, well, he says, I'd rather eat dessert than hear me speak. So I said, okay, we'll eat dessert first. So he was just a great guy. And he told me similar stories about Mises being very, very humble, okay? It doesn't mean that they didn't know that they had superior intellectual abilities. There was no false modesty about Rothbard, and from what I could see, no false modesty about Mises. If they believe they developed the correct theory, they told you so. This is the correct theory. They didn't emphasize that I developed it. They emphasized that this is the correct theory. And on the other hand, if someone went beyond them or showed that their theory might be slightly wrong or not complete, as I did in one small instance with Rothbard on the socialist calculation debate, where I showed that Mises actually believed and showed that the problem of calculation was not one of knowledge but of calculation, and that that Hayek and Mises were very, very different than what they were saying. He wrote me like a 5-page letter, you know, saying what a great article it was, that I went beyond him and so on. And, I was extremely flattered. I wasn't the only one, though, that got these types of letters. So whenever anyone, and in the letter he says, people say that I'm intolerant, meaning he, Rothbard. He says, but I'm not intolerant of people that go beyond me, advance me, give more hardcore presentations of Austrian economics. He says, what I object to is people who sort of degenerate away from the praxeological paradigm. So, it was like one of the highlights of my life to get this letter from this, you know, this genius. They both, by the way, believed that they weren't trying to recreate economics from the ground up, okay, as some Austrians today, younger Austrians today, believe that they're doing. They both believed that they were simply advancing the work of their own masters. So in Rothbard's case, Mises was his master. In Mises' case, von Bawerk was his master. And they treated these men with great respect. And they didn't criticize them until very late in their lives. Mises wrote an article criticizing von Bawerk and Menger's value theory, that they were inconsistent in 1932. He was already in his 50s, well into his 50s. And I was present when Rothbard criticized Mises' welfare theory, where Mises was really a utilitarian and didn't believe that ethics was an objective discipline. And Rothbard did that in 1974. Okay, so he was born in 1926, so he was in his 40s when he did that. And afterwards, he told us that, me and a few others, when he sat down after his talk, he says he was a little bit shaky criticizing Mises in public. So, you know, despite the fact that he was a genius and developed the whole system of economic thought himself, he was very, very respectful of his master and careful about criticizing them. You don't see those things today to the same extent, unfortunately, among many Austrians. One Austrian, for example, while still a graduate student, just out of graduate school, said something like, not only should we stand on Mises' shoulders, which is a common metaphor that you stand on the shoulders of the giant so you can even see further. So you can advance the science further than them. But this person said we should kick Mises in the head. Okay. Both published comprehensive treatises on economics at crucial periods in the history of economic thought when the Austrian school was about to die. Okay, both published books, Human Action in Mises' case, Man, Economy, State, and Rothbard's case, that really saved sound economics, that is Austrian economics, from extinction. And we'll get to that. And finally, both were passionate and intransigent seekers of truth. I would call both of them that. They never deviated from Karl Menger's original vision that economic phenomena were always rooted in the evaluations and choices of individual human beings. Okay. Now, what I want to tell you is two stories, one of which is wrong, one of which is right. The conventional view of the rise, the fall, because there was a rise and fall of Austrian economics, and then a rebirth in the 1970s, was never really put forth anywhere, but is in the works. If you read Israel Kirzner's works, who was also a student of Mises at NYU and his graduate assistant, but who had an influence from both Hayek and Mises, to a much greater extent than Rothbard was influenced by Hayek, though Rothbard was influenced by him. So it's in the works of Israel Kirzner and Bruce Caldwell, who wrote a biography of Hayek called Hayek's Challenge. He basically picked up the strands of Kirzner's story. And so I call this the conventional view. This is the view that I believed into the 1990s, and most, there was no other view, Caldwell. Then in the 1990s, I was sort of dissatisfied with this view. I was working on other things, and I began to realize that there was a difference between Mises and Hayek. And so I wrote a paper called Mises and Hayek, A Dehomogenation, dehomogenizing them, showing where their views differed. Okay. But then as time went on, I realized that it wasn't just a difference between Mises and Hayek or Kirzner and Rothbard, but it went back in history, back to Menger. The two brothers-in-law, okay, von Bavrick was the brother-in-law of Wieser, they were the main students of Menger, differed in their views, as we'll see. And so that there were two strands of Austrian economics, one that descended from Wieser, okay, and Hayek points this out in a number of his publications, the other that went through Mises and to Rothbard. Okay, so I discovered at the same time Guido Holstmann was working on his great treatise on Mises, The Last Night of Liberalism, and he gave me some other insights into the German literature. So I call it, this is the revisionist view, Salerno. Okay. All right. So let me tell you this view first, because this view, I think, it can be pretty easily dismissed, okay? It's the following. Austrian economics was at the top of the world and was riding high from the time Menger wrote through the 1930s, especially when Hayek brought to Great Britain and other economists, such as Fritz Machlup, brought to the United States the Austrian theory of the business cycle, which seemed to explain the Great Depression. And that was done in 1931. Then suddenly in 1936, while Austrian school's riding high, John Maynard Keynes, okay, I expect you to hiss when I use that. Yeah, that's okay. Keynes wrote his book, The General Theory of Employment, Interest, and Money, okay? And the Austrian theory of the business cycle, and therefore Austrian economics, there's a problem right there. There's much more to Austrian economics than just the Austrian theory of the business cycle, was buried by a Keynesian avalanche. There's a book called The Keynesian Avalanche. So this is sort of the Keynesian avalanche view of the death of Austrian economics. Out of nowhere, this Keynesian avalanche came, buried Austrian economics, no one refuted it, everybody just forgot it. That's it. It's gone, okay? That's kind of fishy. That's not the way things happen in the history of economic thought. Then, miraculously, in 1974, and I call this the Big Bang theory of the Austrian rebirth, because it seemed to come from nowhere, right? From nothing, ex nihilo. People just hanging around and being Keynesians and stuff, and you know, that's cool. And You know, Keynesianism is coming in for criticism because since the middle of the 1960s, the Vietnam War, we have a higher inflation than we had during the post-war period. And for the first time in 69, 70, we have a recession and we have an inflation at the same time, which is called stagflation. And so people are starting to lose confidence in Keynesian economics, but they're turning to monetarism more than anything else. But suddenly there's a conference that's held at a small and scary town, actually, South Royalton, Vermont. It's the middle of nowhere. You can actually, at night, you can hear the wolves in the distance. I thought it was in Transylvania. It was ridiculous. No, seriously, it was howling dogs and stuff, and very weird people. Some of us were at an inn, but other people, like myself, were stuck at these houses where people in the town lived. And it was like Stepford Wives. You know, you'd walk in, and they would just be, and then they would walk on, you know. So it was very, very strange. All right, so this comes out of nowhere in June of 1974, and then, miraculously, Hayek wins the Nobel Prize in October 1974, and suddenly, we have a big Austrian rebirth. Remember the movie, what's the baseball movie with Kevin Costner, Field of Dreams? Why was this conference held? I mean, is it true that, you know, did someone say to the sponsors, if you hold it, they will come? As they, you know, if you build it, they will come. Okay, no, of course not. That's not the way things happen in the theory of history of economic thought either. Okay, so that is the conventional view. I am caricaturing it a bit. There's a little bit more detail in it, but I think that's the outlines. Okay, I don't think I'm misrepresenting the outlines of that theory. Sort of the Keynesian avalanche, Austrian economics disappears, Big Bang occurs with South Royalton. Out of nothing, we suddenly have this thriving revival of Austrian economics. Okay, and so that's the Keynesian avalanche / Big Bang theory of the death and then rebirth of Austrian economics. Okay, now there's a number of things wrong with this theory that I'll just mention now. Then I'll go through the revisionist, correct, Salerno. Okay, the first thing wrong with it is that it attributes almost no role in the rebirth to Rothbard or even to Mises, okay? If any personality is mentioned, it's Hayek, and then it's this sort of conference. That's all it's mentioned. That's number one. That's one thing that's wrong with it. Secondly, it treats the Austrian school before the 1930s as a monolithic entity, but there were a lot of controversies. There was a distinction in a very general way between two different traditions. It ignores all of that. It doesn't talk about all of that. Okay, that's another problem. It does not deal with the crucial importance of institutions. Okay, Austrian economics, like all intellectual movements, needs real resources to exist. I mean, if Menger never had a pen, a desk, paper, a university position, he couldn't make his contribution. You need real things, okay, to have an intellectual movement. And when the supply of, when the institutional infrastructure, meaning all of the institutions as well as the real resources, change, the movement can change, okay, and will change. Can also disappear, as it did for a while, all right. So it talks about people involved in this movement as almost ghosts or disembodied minds that just moved around and just spoke to one another and they convinced one another just through pure intellectual argument. That's also not the way intellectual movements develop, okay? I mean, how all of a sudden did we get Nazi biology in Germany? How all of a sudden did we get Soviet physics, okay? They threw out all of the other professors, basically. They took away their means of intellectual work and so on, and they staffed these positions with, you know, Nazi professors and Soviet physicists and so on. Okay, so the movement can change when these institutions change. All right. Also, it leaves out of account a big thriving Austrian school that developed in the United States and Great Britain from around the 1890s and existed to about World War I. It doesn't say anything about that. I'll say a few things about that in my story here. Okay. And it leaves out Joseph Schumpeter, who's although he's not considered intellectually an Austrian economist, he's considered, well, he is a native Austrian. And he did have Wieser as his teacher, and he also had von Bawerk as his teacher. He knew Mises. He was in the same seminar, von Bawerk seminar with Mises. He wrote two books. He was a star, as we'll see, in the first decade of the 20th century. He was a star Austrian. It wasn't Mises. He was a star of the third generation. And he is the one that influenced the fourth generation, as well as Wieser, who was their teacher, as we'll see. Okay? So it leaves out, and this is something that Guido did point out to me, that how important Schumpeter was in this story. Okay. And finally, this story portrays Murray Rothbard as a libertarian activist. So supposedly by the 1970s, he was really a libertarian activist. He had abandoned economics. Just a whole bunch of nonsense. Okay. So there's a lot of things that are wrong with this. And so when I looked in two articles that I wrote on this to try to tell the story in a way that made more sense and that took into account these neglected factors, I found that really Rothbard had a central place in the rebirth. Okay. All right, let me just say a few words about why the Austrian school died to begin with. It wasn't because of the Keynesian avalanche, okay? It was dying before that. Basically, here's what happened. Okay, Menger had these two followers, all right? Bombavarek was the smartest and was brilliant. And in the 1880s, he came out with a number of important publications. And some of these, by the 1890s, began to be published in English, as well as some of Wieser's work and some of the other followers of Menger. And by the early 1890s, the Austrian school had an international reputation. It was on the cutting edge of economic theory. Okay. Unfortunately, Bombavarek left academic life. Okay. So here's a change of institutions. In 1889, and went to work for the Austrian government until 1904, okay, as its finance minister. He had a number of stints as its finance minister. He therefore did not really do any more important positive work during that period. Though in the 1890s, he defended his theory of capital and interest and really of general macroeconomics from all attacks from all over the world. Okay, people from his critics. Okay, so he was out of the picture. He was no longer a bigger influence. Okay, in the meantime, Menger retires in 1903. From the University of Vienna, the premier center of intellectual work in Austria, and his chair is taken over by Wieser. Okay, now Wieser is not a pure Mengerian. He has a lot of influences from the mathematical school, from Walras. What he wants to do is to come up with some sort of way of determining when society has a maximum social utility. He believes you could actually add up utility, whereas Menger and Bombavarek really didn't. And he tries to use the law of marginal utility to combine it with some sort of psychological laws that will allow him to say something about when society is using its resources in the best way possible, when there's a maximum social utility, okay? So he's really a general equilibrium economist, but using general equilibrium applies to the sort of economic system we have today, in which people are treated as stones and atoms, and it can be described, their actions can be described with a system of simultaneous equations. Okay, he's not quite at that level of mathematician, but accepts this in general. Okay, Schumpeter's his student, and Schumpeter writes two very, very important books in 1908. In 1911. The first one makes him famous in Austria. It's called The Nature and Necessity of Economic Theory, and it defends more explicitly than Wieser general equilibrium theory. Okay, even though Schumpeter is actually a lousy mathematician, he holds that the greatest star of economics, he makes some statement like that, is Leon Walras, the father of mathematical economics. Okay, this makes him famous in Austria itself, but then he writes a book called It's not a business cycle, and it's called The Theory of Economic Development, and this brings him worldwide fame. So, what happens? After World War I, Wieser is the main professor at the University of Vienna. The fourth generation of very, very distinguished economists come in. They come in 1918 through 1921. Wieser's their teacher. They learn all their economics from Wieser, and they read these two books. Okay. Now, Mises... They know who Mises is. Mises is an unpaid lecturer there. Hayek admits that he never took Mises' class. He went into the first class and thought Mises was arrogant and left. So he never took Mises' class. Really, the only one who did was Machlup, who took Mises' class. So Mises had written a book on the theory of money and credit in 1912. And then in 1922, he writes his great book on socialism. But by then, these people already have their PhDs. Okay, they believe that Mises is a great mind, but they think of him as more of a political economist, someone who's writing about economic problems, such as socialism and money. They don't think of him as a great theorist like Schumpeter or Wieser, their teacher. Okay, so these people have a strong general equilibrium influence, though they are influenced by indirectly by Menger. The other thing, Menger does not allow his book to be republished. While he lived until 1921, remember, he wrote his book in 1871, it was out of publication. Okay, it was hard to find in the libraries and so on. So they don't even necessarily have access to Menger's book. Yes, he didn't think it was perfect. He kept working on it, and he was making it worse and worse. He made it worse, you know, because he was sort of an old guy by then, and you know he's losing his edge, intellectual edge, and so. His son brings out the second edition sometime in the 1920s, and Mises says somewhere that it is by far no improvement on the original edition. Okay, so we have that happening. Then over here, as I said, Mises is only an unpaid lecturer, and Bohm Bawerk comes back. Okay, this is the point I want to make. Okay, he comes back to the academia in 1905. They create a special chair for him. Okay. But by then, he's really an old man. I mean, let me just read you some things that he says about himself and that Mises says about him, okay? Thus, upon his return to academic life at the age of 54, okay, so he returns at 54, he gives up the most productive time of his life to the government, okay, which is, you know, always a crazy thing to do. It'll just, you know, suck the life right out of you if you're any kind of an honest, intelligent person. And so an observer says, he seemed older than his years suggested. Then 2 years later, he himself, in a letter, Bohm Bawerk himself says, or describes himself as, quote, an old man. And then this is what Mises says about him. Mises, who attended Bohm Bawerk's famous seminar at the university between 1905 and 1913, observed that in this period, Bohm Bawerk, I'm quoting from Mises, Bohm Bawerk could have produced much more if conditions had permitted it. But his physical constitution could no longer stand the hard work necessary to embark upon great works. His nerves were failing him. The two-hour seminar already taxed his strength. He gave a two-hour seminar per week, and he could barely get through that. So his influence is diminished. And then he dies prematurely in 1914 of a heart attack. There are rumors that he committed suicide. Rothbard said there were rumors around that he had committed suicide. So he's not really a factor, okay? So the Austrian school, the pure Mengerian school, is already dying, okay? By 1914, Wieser comes out with his treatise, and everyone thinks, well, this is the greatest product of the Austrian school. This is a full treatise on economics. It's called The Theory of Social Economy. This is the Austrian school, okay? And this is what he taught to his students, and plus they read these books. Okay, so the point was that Austrian economics began to die in Austria itself by 1914. It wasn't a Keynesian avalanche. That's number one. There's a couple of other factors. As I said, there was a great, I might call it a Anglo-American school. Oh, let me mention one other thing here. As I said, these people were allowed to attend Mises's private seminar. It was very famous. So everyone believed that they were students of Mises. But they could only attend after they got their PhDs. Okay, so they begin attending in 1922, 1923, after they already formed as economists by Wieser and by Schumpeter. Okay, and they do not realize how great Mises is as an economic system builder. They think Schumpeter is a great builder and Wieser is a great system builder until Mises begins to comes out with a book of articles in 1933 called The Epistemological Problems of Economics, which he began writing in 1928. But by then, they are mature economists. They're almost 30 years old. So Mises was not their mentor, okay? Perhaps he was closest to Hayek, okay? But even then, Hayek worked under him and did attend the private seminar, but Hayek's mind had already been formed. Okay, so I did want to mention that. Then something else happens. All right, so we have Bohm Bawerk, really, had he not gone into government service and died prematurely, this could have all been very, very different, okay? So that's one aspect where institutions matter. Then we have the Marshallian Revolution, okay? I hate Alfred Marshall almost as much as I hate Keynes. And he was Keynes' teacher, by the way. By the way, Keynes only took one course in economics. Okay, he took one course in economics, and he it was taught by Marshall. And Marshall was told, and Keynes often said to younger economists, "You don't have to know anything but Marshall's book. Just read the principles and read the Financial Times every day, and you'll be an economist." Okay. So what Alfred Marshall publishes a very famous textbook. I mean, that was used. It was first published in 1890. It was used in American universities into the 1940s because Murray Rothbard used it in his micro class at Columbia in the 1940s. Okay, so that's how famous this book was. Now, initially, Marshall says, yeah, the Austrians are right, and it was good what they did, but they were only half right. The Austrians all went overboard. They put too much emphasis on the subjective. He said, in fact, value, or price rather, is determined by two blades of a scissor. The demand curve, which is based on subjective valuations, marginal utility, if you will, and the supply curve, which is based on cost of production. So what Marshall tried to do was to revive and combine David Ricardo, the classical economist, and the Austrians. And he's very sneaky and snide and couldn't take criticism. When Bombavar criticized him, he wrote very, very nasty letters about Bombavar to his friends and so on, calling Bombavar, he doesn't know mathematical economics and so on, which of course wasn't the point at all. So Marshall writes this book. It seems very, very, and it becomes very popular very quickly, okay? By 1910, it completely dominates almost all British universities use it. And by the 20s, most American universities begin to use it. So the Austrians, even they're in the rest of the world, okay, after World War I, by the 1920s, the only kind of economic theory that people are talking about, because Walras's mathematical economics is still very small, the only kind of economic theory people are talking about is Alfred Marshall's economic theory, which leads us to the third institutional development, and that is that there was a great school of Anglo-American Austrian, meaning British American. I don't know why they call them Anglo-American or why Anglo gets the nod. Remember, there are three tribes that settled Great Britain: the Angles, the Saxons, and the Jutes. I mean, what about Jute American Austrians or Saxon American Austrians? In any case, Anglo-American Austrians. And so in the U.S., we have these great economic theorists, Frank Fetter, who immediately accepts Mengers and Bombavar's work, Herbert J. Davenport. He's at Princeton, he's at Cornell, they're at great universities. They have a lot of influence. And even before them, John Bates Clark, who actually came up with his own version of marginal utility sometime in the 1880s without having really read the others. But he accepts Menger. He says, Menger did develop this theory before I did, and I'm very sympathetic to what Menger had to say, and so on. So he was really the father of this. They began to be called, wrongly, the American Psychological School. Instead of subjectivist, they use psychological. So the American Psychological School in England, in the U.S., then in Great Britain, we have a great guy who does not have any sort of position, though. His name is Philip Wicksteed. He writes a two-volume Common Sense of Political Economy. And there's a few others who translate the works of Bombavar and Wieser. William Smart's one of them. All right, so you have these people accepting Menger and Bombavar and so on. What happens? They, within the space of a few years, right around World War I, three of them come out with great treatises. Okay, Fetter writes Economic Principles. I think that came out in 1915. Davenport writes Enterprise and, I can't remember the full name of the book, but it has Enterprise in the title. And Wicksteed writes his treatise. I think it was like 1911, 1912, and then 1915. But by then, they're older, so that after World War II, they pretty much stop contributing to economic theory. So there's a vacuum in economic theory, so Marshallian economics comes right in the U.S., okay? And Wicksteed, as I said, had many different interests. He never had a university position. He was a Unitarian minister. He was a minister of some kind. He did a lot of work translating Greek translations and biblical translations and so on. All right, William Smart becomes a turncoat and becomes a Marshallian later on. So the Austrian school is almost completely dead now, okay, by the 1920s, certainly by the early 30s. The microeconomics of the Austrian school, which really is the foundation of the macroeconomics of the business cycle theory, is almost completely gone. What's left of it is sort of this verbal general equilibrium. And then the worst possible, oh, one other thing here. The American Psychological School, they had graduate students, but Davenport and Fetter, for whatever reason, hated one another personally with a passion, and they fought. Okay, this is make a great dissertation for somebody. And they never generated any followers. There was one guy named Vernon Mund who wrote on monopoly theory, who was very good, but he didn't have a really big name. Okay, so they leave no followers. And Wicksteed, again, doesn't have any graduate students. Yeah, go ahead. Yeah, well, I mean, Princeton, as I said, was Fetter, and Davenport was at Cornell. Okay, I actually found one follower of both of them who wrote a small textbook for sort of introductory economic students, okay, besides the guy who wrote on monopoly. But people forget them, okay? I've actually done some work. There's actually a few people that were scattered around, but they didn't have the sort of reputations that these guys had. All right, so no one's left. And now the final thing happens, final institutional development that involves Hayek, and that is Hayek gives a series of brilliant lectures on the Austrian business cycle theory at the London School of Economics, which is the last bastion of Austrian economics in the English-speaking world, okay? And the chairman of the department is Lionel Robbins, who wrote a great praxeological treatise on the nature and significance of economic theory that came out in 1932, in which he destroyed the historical school, destroyed the Marshallians, and cited Mises and Striegel and von Bawerk and Menger and Schumpeter, and cited all the Austrians in there. And he's a chairman, so he brings Hayek over, and Hayek gives these brilliant lectures, and they invite him to become a member of the London School of Economics, the most prestigious non-Marshallian, non-Keynesian bastion of economics. And there's a few other people there. Robbins actually took his, read Wicksteed, and so he also got some Austrianism through Wicksteed. There was another guy who liked Menger, Edwin Cannon, who was Robbins' teacher and the prior chairman, okay? They're not quite as important, but so he brings in a lot of these students of Cannon and of his own, and so there's an Austrian department there. And one of these students is John Hicks, who turns out to be a great mathematician, Hicks. So what does Hicks do? Hayek and Robbins realize that Hicks is brilliant. He writes a sort of an Austrian theory of wages, a book on wages and how marginal productivity determines wages, and unions really can't change the level of wages for the whole whole economy or for the whole labor force. He writes that in 1932. But then Hayek, for some nutty reason, tells him he should read Pareto. Pareto's a mathematical economist. So Hicks reads Pareto and then begins to develop an explicit mathematical general equilibrium theory. It's brought for the first time to the English-speaking world from the French, okay? And so Hicks starts, really, the whole theory of general equilibrium in the English-speaking world. And unfortunately, both Hayek and Robbins think that this is fine. It's just an alternative way of stating what Mises and Menger had to, what Menger and von Bawerk had to say in just more rigorous mathematical form. And what's interesting is what Hicks says. You can see his reading list starts to change for his classes. Okay, and you can see that he's putting more and more sort of neoclassical mathematical authors on his reading list. Let me just read a little paragraph from my article. By the mid-1930s, Robbins had begun to fall under the sway of Hayek and Hicks, confusing the dynamic Menger-Wicksteed price theory, okay, with the Walrasian pure logic of choice. Okay, where you simply set out this choice as a maximum in mathematical form. It isn't really choice at all. For example, in his syllabus for the course on general principles of economic analysis, which he gave during the 1934-1935 session, Robbins included under the headings, okay, modern works in general theory, he included treatises by von Bawerk, Wicksteed, Fetter, Clark, and Davenport, all pure Austrians. Alongside that, he included Castle, who was a German general equilibrium theorist, Pareto, and in a revealing note, okay, so he's starting to change in 34, 35. In a revealing note in the syllabus, Robbins wrote, "The treatment will be non-mathematical in character, Students who wish to witness the same problems treated mathematically should attend course number 66, Introduction to Mathematical Economics. So what is he saying here? That there's really no difference between the Austrians and the mathematical school, except the Austrians are saying the same thing verbally. Okay, and what does that tell you? It tells you, well, you know what? You're saying it verbally, it's less efficient, it's less economic, you're using more words, you can use fewer symbols to say the same thing, and it's less elegant, and it's less precise, because you're not using mathematics. And then in 1939, he struck out treatises by Clark, Fetter, and Davenport. He kept Pareto's mathematical book, and then added an article by Hicks and Allen on a reconsideration of the theory of value, which is sort of the main or seminal work of mathematical general equilibrium theory, okay? And he adds other books that are sort of non-Austrian. So because of Hayek's introduction of Hicks to Pareto, and because Hayek himself didn't clearly see the difference between the mathematical treatment, he did later on, but between a mathematical treatment and the purely verbal, logical, praxeological treatment of economics, that really put the nail in the coffin of the Austrian school. Okay, this was all before Keynes wrote his book. So all that was left was the Austrian theory of the business cycle, and then Keynes certainly did bury that. But the core of economics, the price theory, the value theory, all began to fall apart much before Keynes. Okay, now there were a few problems with Menger's approach. And they were, one of the problems with Menger and Bombavark was that they didn't clearly explain why we needed equilibrium at all. We do need it, but we need it for very, very narrow purposes, okay, which Mises was finally the one to point out later on in Human Action. Also, Menger and Bombavark did not accept Mises' work on money, which integrated value theory with monetary theory. They still treated the economy as a barter economy, which is exactly the way the mathematical economists treat the economy. It's very difficult for them to integrate money because for money you need uncertainty. There's no uncertainty under equilibrium where everybody knows everything. If you knew exactly how much you were going to spend throughout the rest of your life and exactly when you would get your income, okay, on what date you would get your income, you wouldn't want to hold any money. What you would do is you would invest all your money as soon as you got it for periods reflecting the next time you would need that to come due. There'd be different maturities. No one would want to hold money. If everyone tried to get rid of their money that way, prices would explode into infinity and the economy would collapse, as Mises pointed out. So this was another problem with the Mengerian, with the original treatment, which again, Mises fixed. And they also left out the entrepreneur. They didn't focus real heavily on the entrepreneur. I mean, they did to some extent, but the mathematical school doesn't need an entrepreneur. There is no entrepreneur in the equations of general equilibrium, okay? There's just resource owners, there's supplies and demands, and somehow they magically come together. Okay, anyway, all of this happens. All right, so now let's get to Mises very quickly. He saw what was happening, and he realized how serious it was, that Menger's original vision was about to die, that mathematical economics and then Keynesian economics, and including Marshallian economics, it was a whole mix-up of Marshall's partial equilibrium. Marshall treated each market in isolation, okay, and didn't look at the overall economy. The general equilibrium theorists did look at the overall economy, but they treated it unrealistically as if it were a system of equations as in classical mechanics. Marshall didn't focus on the consumer, but on the businessman, just like the classical school did. So these are all problems. But to make a long story short, these views dominated and the Austrian view got pushed out. Okay, so Mises then leaves Austria in 1934, gets a position in Switzerland, in Geneva, at the Graduate Institute of Economic Research, or I can't remember the exact name, but from 1934 to 1940, or 1939, he really rarely writes anything, and he's very prolific. He writes a few book reviews, one or two scholarly articles, some popular articles for newspapers and magazines. Why? Because he's working on rehabilitating Mengerian economics, okay? And that book came out in 1940. It was called National Economy. It was the German predecessor to Human Action. And unfortunately, it comes out in 1940, the war has broken out. He's in Switzerland, and he's cut off from the German language market. So the book dies on the vine. So just to speed this up a little bit, in the 1940s, for various reasons, including helping with the war effort, American and British economists begin to work for government. Governments like statistics. They like mathematical models telling them what's going to happen if they do one thing or another thing. And you get a movement towards general equilibrium and Marshallian economics. By 1949, when things open up again and Mises publishes Human Action, no one cares about the book, okay? What happens is that Mises gets a few students, okay, comes to the United States in 1940, gets a few students in the 1950s. He's teaching at NYU in his seminar, Rothbard, Kirzner, Henry Hazlitt, Hans Senholtz, and others. And during the 1950s, not much happens. Austrian economics is all but dead, right? And so let me just give you sort of the end of this story, or bring it up to date very quickly. So Austrian economics is almost dead. Only a few things are published in the 1950s, including a few books by Hazlitt attacking the Keynesian economics, the failure of the new economics. He publishes a book. Ludwig Lachmann publishes a very good book on capital in 1956 called Structure of Capital. Rothbard publishes a great article attacking neoclassical utility and welfare economics called Towards a Reconstruction of Utility and Welfare Economics. And Israel Kirzner publishes a book in 1960 on the economic point of view, in which he shows how all other definitions of economics are really inferior to the definition that Mises gives in terms of praxeology. But no one's paying attention to any of this, okay? And so Austrian economics is dormant. And then something happens. Rothbard finishes Man, Economy, and State in 1962. So we have State. Just when Austrian economics seems like it's almost completely dead, we just have a few works here and there. In 1963, he publishes America's Great Depression, explaining why it wasn't the free market, as everyone thought, but in fact, Federal Reserve System intervention into the economy that brings about the inflation of the and boom of the 1920s and then the collapse into the Great Depression. He also publishes a book on what has government done to our money, a small pamphlet that comes out, I think, in 1960, I think it was 61, actually. So he's enormously prolific, okay, to publish all these works. Okay, he's been working on these works in the 1950s, and he publishes them. And here, I claim, is the beginning of the revival of Austrian economics. Now, why would I say that? Because all of the young people, the 30 participants that show up at South Royalton in 1974, is 30, to hear Rothbard, Murray Rothbard, give lectures, Israel Kirzner gave lectures, and Ludwig Lachmann gave lectures. Where did those 30 people come from? I mean, they just show up? No, of course not. During the 1960s, most of them are graduate students, such as myself, or they're young professors, okay, very young professors. And everyone is steeped in Rothbard's Man, Economy, and State. Everybody at that conference, almost without exception, is a Rothbardian. So before you can have an intellectual movement, you have to have some sort of unifying, integrating treatise. And this treatise, which then refers back to Human Action. So if everyone reads Man, Economy, and State, then goes back and reads America's Great Depression, and then reads Human Action. Everyone has read these books. Now, Kirzner published a very famous book in 1972 entitled Competition Entrepreneurship, very good book. But by the time he publishes that book, everyone is already a Rothbardian, okay? And this is just an added benefit to have this book published. Okay, so, actually, it came out in 1973, Competition Entrepreneurship. Okay, before this conference, all of these young Austrians, or would-be Austrians, are in isolation. They don't really know one another, okay? I remember when I was reading America's Great Depression, I was working in the summer between, interlude in college, in my summer job. I was working as a janitor, and I used to get my work done really quickly. And then I would go into this broom closet with just one little light, and I'd be reading America's Great Depression. I mean, I felt so alone. I was alone. It was in that broom closet with the light. But that's how everybody was. And then when we met each other, it was unbelievable to meet other people like Richard Ebling and Don Lavoie and all these other people that were my in my cohort, okay? So that's what starts the revival. So I don't date the revival from 1974. That's sort of the culmination, okay, where people recognize each other and suddenly there's a movement. But the revival begins intellectually in, I think, with the publication of Man, Economy, and State. So that's very important. So I call this, there's three phases of the revival. And this was the first phase. I call this Genius in Bloom, in which Rothbard publishes these works. He goes on and publishes very quickly later on In 1970, he publishes Power and Market, which was supposed to be the third volume of Man, Economy, and State, okay, and is now included in the latest edition. Okay, but they made him cut it out because it was too radical in its political economic conclusions, saying that we could have defense services without a state. Okay, and then in 1973, he publishes his overall vision in political economy, which is for new liberty. And so by the time 1974 rolls around, everybody's read all of this stuff. And everyone is a Rothbardian. Okay. Then something happened. Now we have a number of conferences from 74 to 76. We have a number of conferences financed by IHS, Institute for Humane Studies. And the second one, 75, is at Hartford, University of Hartford. And it's for the younger scholars like myself, who are still graduate students, who write papers. And then the senior scholars comment on them. Well, my first academic paper I ever gave was commented on by Israel Kirzner. And Hayek was there. And Hayek got up and commented on it, which was, you know, really, really intimidating. I mean, he's really tall. And scarier than Hans. Very aloof, you know. And then 1976, there's another conference in England. But then after that, the institutions change. IHS, as well as other sort of foundations that were free market foundations that finance Austrian economic programs, is taken over by a billionaire is changed. And what they want to do is they want to get instant credibility in the mainstream. So they begin to downplay, over time, the more radical Austrians, Mises and Rothbard. And they play up the Austrians who are much more, let's say, gentle in their approach, who tend to be more outreachy. They reach out to the rest of the profession. So they play up Kirzner and they play up Hayek, okay? And they give funds to Kirzner to start a program in the late 70s at NYU in economics. There's also money to start a program, and I was in this program from 78 to 80 at Rutgers University, okay? That program actually went after 1980 to GMU, okay? So Rothbard loses an institutional home. He has no institutions backing him any longer, okay? He has a fight and a falling out with these people in 1982 over certain things with the Cato Institute and IHS. And yet does he become a libertarian activist? That's the last thing I'll drop that completely out of economics. This is what some of the people at GMU would want you to believe, that it's really Kirzner who dominates Austrian economics from the late 1970s onward, because Rothbard has abandoned economic theory and he has become a libertarian activist, you know, which is they say in a sneering way, you're an activist. So you can't be a thinker if you're an activist. So what does Rothbard write? Let's see. During that time, I'll end with that. Yeah, he writes a number of brilliant economic essays. The Myth of Neutral Taxation comes out in 81. Law, Property Rights, and Air Pollution comes out in 82. The Federal Reserve as a Cartelization Device in 84. The Case for the Genuine Gold Dollar in 1985. He also publishes two books, The Ethics of Liberty in 82 and The Mystery of Banking in 83. This is hardly the work of purely a libertarian activist. Okay, so Rothbard's out of it until he finds a new institutional home. We'll bring you up to date. New institutional home is founded in 1982. It's the Mises Institute. And it brings Rothbardian thought back into the center of Austrian economics. By 1987, we have the Review of Austrian Economics started. And you then begin getting economists grouping themselves around the Mises Institute, those that were Rothbardians and never really went along with sort of the other branch of Austrian economics. And now we have, from the sixth generation, then we have a seventh generation, Peter Klein, Guido Hulsman, the seventh generation. They come into it in the 1990s or so. And now we're working on the eighth generation. But if it was not for the Mises Institute, I think Rothbard's message, okay, because he really didn't have that movement infrastructure, the institution that he needed, like the Mises Institute, I think would have been lost in the 1980s. He would have been writing for himself. He may have had a few friends around like myself, but his message would not have gone out as broadly as it did, would not have influenced Ron Paul as it has. And so institutions have a very important effect on intellectual movement. My watch has 1/4 of, but that one says we have 5 minutes. I'll take some questions until it's, yeah, Mike? Yeah, it wasn't, specifically it was about the fact that Cato Institute Well, they had been fighting over sort of libertarian politics, which, you know, was, I didn't think Rothbard should have got involved in that. But at that point, they hired a monetarist economist. He's a nice guy. Instead of an Austrian economist, to be sort of the in-house economist. They began hiring Austrians and discriminating in their conferences against, they began hiring non-Austrians and discriminating against Austrians. I went to a conference in 1978, a huge conference on inflation at Rutgers, you know, with this money from this institute, and it was all big names like Martin Feldstein, Republican economists, and there were few of us who we didn't have any reputations. So basically, when it got publicized in the New York Times, they just mentioned the non-Austrians, and you know everybody else's name was left out. But this is what they were looking for. I mean, that's one strategy, okay, to soften the message. Austrian economics without you know who. That was when everyone forgot about Mises, when they downplayed Mises from about 1976 onward to 1983, when the Mises Institute was started. In fact, when Lou Rockwell started the Mises Institute, he called up the collection of people that were, you know, sort of in the Cato groupings, and he said, you know, I'd like funds for, you know, to start this up. And they said, don't start that Mises Institute. No one likes Mises. Hayek is much more palatable to everyone. Even Milton Friedman doesn't like Mises. They commanded him not to start the Mises Institute. So that's when he turned to sort of a grassroots type institute. You go to people all over the country. Okay. So again, it's a legitimate difference in strategy, but it was there, and they didn't want to mention Mises' name. He was too radical, too intransigent. Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Pete Betke. Sure. Yeah. Right. Right, 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 right. Yeah. Well, I mean, if you hear Pete Betke give formal lectures, he'll say that the great philosopher was Lachmann, the one who had the philosophical sophistication. The economist who engages in technical economics is Kirzner, and the libertarian activist is Rothbard. Now, they were influenced by Rothbard as a libertarian activist, no doubt about it. They're anarcho-capitalist because of him, but they don't take his economics seriously, I would argue, except maybe Ben Powell does. But I would argue that. I mean, I would argue that openly. And I have had exchanges with Pete on the internet, Pete Betke on the internet about it. Yes. And then you back there. Go ahead. You first. The what state? What did Hayek think about? I heard Hayek once say at a conference that he was too old by the time that came out to absorb new systems. He had his own system, and he said he couldn't even absorb human action, because that came out in 49. Hayek had already been developing his own system of thought. And also, Hayek has written that he was part of this, explicitly said he was part of this tradition, but he said that Rothbard and Kurzer and so on, they were really part of this tradition, and he had thought more would have come of this tradition, but it didn't. So he admitted this tradition had sort of fallen by the wayside. Okay. And last one back there. Yeah, sure. No, because we were all, at the beginning it was very vicious and so on, but everyone's friendly now. I mean, it's, you know. No, it's not, I wouldn't say ideological. In the sense of, we both want the same, both interested politically in a free society, in a totally, let's call it totally voluntary. Strategically, it's very different. It's like they want to hide the message, and when you do that, you tend to lose. People tend to forget. Look, if you're writing non-Austrian economics just to get it into a mainstream journal, then you're not writing Austrian economics, and you're not building up your human capital in Austrian economics. Whereas here, you know, the message is much more open. Okay, I can talk to you after, because it's time to go. Thank you.